Governor Charlie Baker says his office continues to review a report out this week alleging abuse and neglect at a private special education school in the town of Middleborough. The Chamberlain International School is pushing back on the report, claiming bias on behalf of the authors at the Disability Law Center. WBUR's Shannon Dooling reports.
The Boston-based nonprofit has federal authority to protect the rights of people with disabilities. The Law Center report found Chamberlain staff were neglectful in preventing student suicide attempts and runaways. The report also cites verbal abuse of students by staff. Chamberlain attorney Eric McLeish says the Law Center's report contains misinformation and that the center was out to embarrass the school. McLeish is calling on Governor Baker to revoke the Law Center's authority to conduct such investigations.
When you have an organization with an advocacy and lobbying agenda that purports to have done an objective investigation, we believe that creates an inherent conflict of interest. So yes, we're going to be asking for either another nonprofit organization or another organization within state government to do the kind of protection and advocacy investigations that are currently entrusted to the DLC.
Governor Baker says he believes the Law Center has a long track record of good work and that his office needs more time to review the report before taking any corrective action.
But I think the Disability Law Center is a good organization. I think Chamberlain is also a good school. I don't think anybody should draw a lot of conclusions about that until we have a chance to figure out the date specifics associated with some of the allegations and the follow-up on that.
In response to Attorney McLeish's claim of bias, the Law Center says they conducted this investigation with no motive or agenda, but rather followed where the evidence led them. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh made a big promise in his 2013 campaign for mayor, universal preschool for every child in Boston.
Study after study has told us that universal early education and these other changes can be transformative.
But 3 years after Walsh's inauguration, there's still no universal preschool. Not for Boston, not for the state, despite several attempts. What's the holdup? WBUR's Tanya Mosley reports.
Together, away, tippy-tippy-toe around.
A library is the last place you'd expect a party.
Tap your toe upon the ground.
But moms and dads at this South Boston branch are celebrating. Their kids are going to preschool, also known as K-1 in Boston.
So we're really glad we got a spot from the lottery, yeah.
Getting a K-1 spot for your child in the public school system can feel like winning big, because in a way, it is.
My husband and I, you know, we went online, we looked at the rankings, we visited a bunch of them. They have orientation days where you can go in specifically and get a tour.
Emily Wu is talking about the long process she went through to get her 4-year-old daughter Talia a spot in pre-K.
Met the teachers, met the principals, you rank it, and then they randomly assign a number to your child, right? And then I guess, you know, through whatever system they use, you figure out where you end up if you get a spot at all.
This is the second time Wu has applied. Last year, she didn't get a spot. In fact, most of the parents at this celebration have tried and failed before. This year, for instance, over 3,200 students applied for K-1 spots in BPS. About 2,800 got seats.
I'm drawing.
Do you like to draw?
Mm-hmm.
Like Wu, 4-year-old Rosie's mom, Lauren Winnick, also applied twice. The first go-round, she didn't get in. And both times, Winnick started a full year in advance, which means at the beginning of this process, Rosie was one. Winnick believes the system is set up for people with plenty of time and resources.
K-1 wasn't guaranteed for Rosie at this point, so we felt so lucky. And I feel like because I'm home and was able to spend the time applying, that I had an advantage.
Giving all 3- and 4-year-olds in Boston that guarantee is exactly what Mayor Marty Walsh promised when he campaigned 3 years ago. So what happened?
What has been the holdup in implementing universal pre-K in Boston?
I don't know if I'd say necessarily a holdup. I mean, we had the advisory committee moving forward. We're looking at the different issues. I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, it comes down to dollars and costs.
$1.4 billion. That's how much the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, an independent nonprofit, estimates it would cost to pay for universal pre-K statewide. And last spring, Legislators from throughout the state proposed nearly half a dozen bills to pay for universal pre-K. None of those bills made it.
We do a lot of great things, but we've missed the boat on K education.
State Representative Alan Sylvia comes from Fall River, a gateway city, which means the median household income is below the state average. He introduced a bill that would bring universal pre-K to places like Fall River. His bill never made it out of committee.
We were the first state in the country to have a early childhood education program. And I always say Horace Mann rolls in his grave because other states are doing it with ease, and we're not.
Mayor Walsh has created an advisory committee. It's working with a private firm to see how other places, like New York, have not only implemented universal pre-K, but paid for it. The findings will be released in October or November. For now, Boston Public Schools rely on other types of funding, like a federal $3 million preschool expansion grant. 220 additional K-1 seats will be funded through the grant next month.
We had a pre-K seats in Brighton, Jamaica Plain, East Boston, Mattapan, Bay Village, Rosendale, Charlestown. You know, so we broke it across the city. So we tried to put seats in places that may not have gotten them the last couple of cycles, and it's important for us to make sure that parents and children have accessibility to those seats.
Five more minutes, and then it's cleanup time.
In a few weeks, 4-year-old Rosie Winnick will attend Josiah Quincy Elementary in Chinatown.
I like playing with Susie a lot.
It's the first time she'll be away from her baby sister, Susie, and her mom.
I just want her to be happy. Yeah, I could, like, cry. I just want her to fit in and all that.
For parents, this feeling is universal. So far, the experience of preschool is not. For 90.9 WBUR and Edify, I'm Tanya Mosley.
On to politics now. Hillary Clinton's lead in the presidential race polls remains significant, so much so she's already chosen a White House transition team. Meantime, Donald Trump has promised to shake up his campaign again by choosing a new leadership team who are predicted to push even further the candidate's combative, unrestrained style. To talk about this morning, we're joined by our political team, Democrat Dan Payne. Good morning, Dan.
Morning, Bob.
And Republican Todd Domke. Good morning to you, Todd.
Good morning.
So let's start with a Trump campaign shakeup. Stephen Bannon, executive at Breitbart News, who takes a top leadership role in the Trump machine now, has been described as a bare-knuckle fighter. So is this a signal that Trump is digging in for a 12-week brawl? And Dan, let's start with you.
Absolutely. Bannon's been called the most dangerous political operative in America in an exhaustive piece in Bloomberg Politics. Putting him in the same campaign with Donald Trump is like putting gasoline in a match factory. He throws out lies and innuendo and leaves it up to the mainstream media to clean up the mess. And the facts are often misleading or missing.
Yes, hiring Bannon is a sign that Trump wants a flamethrower, not only to scorch his opponent, Hillary Clinton, but also the mainstream media and the Republican establishment. So Trump has turned to a propagandist who specializes in hate because Trump hates to lose. And if he's going to lose, he wants to take down the political system with him. He wants to say the election was rigged by the media, by Wall Street, by the Democratic and Republican Party establishments. So this is a dangerous signal to Republican Party leaders who have been backing Trump, promising that he would change, because now Trump is making clear he will not change. So we should expect more conspiracy theories and more extreme accusations.
Todd, how do you think Donald Trump will now attack Hillary Clinton then?
Well, I think there will be an escalation in his saying she is corrupt, that the Clinton Foundation is corrupt, the special interests supporting her are corrupt, and the mainstream media are corrupt for going against him. And Trump's other message will be that Clinton would be a continuation of the status quo and can't improve the economy or protect the country from terrorism.
I agree with Todd that he'll probably go after the Clinton Foundation. He'll try to insinuate that there was a quid pro quo in contributions to the foundation while she was Secretary of State. Now, this is aimed at a Clinton weakness, her trustworthiness. Bannon's been running Breitbart, a right-wing propaganda machine. It's so far right, it's beyond the pesky poll at Fenway Park.
All right, Hillary Clinton, there's been a lot made in media coverage of Clinton's big lead in the polls and in electoral college votes, but the group 538, a pretty reliable election tracker and predictor, said this week that while the Clinton lead is clear and steady, the race is more likely than not to tighten. What's your take, Dan?
If it continues on its current path, it would wind up being a blowout of biblical proportions, or at least in Goldwater or Mondale proportions. Clinton's leading in traditionally red states like North Carolina and Nevada, and she's got solid leads in Pennsylvania, Florida, and Ohio. With voters so angry and thirsty for change, it seems likely it'll get closer. And Trump finally, after months of being his party's nominee, is starting to run TV spots. Well, Clinton has been punishing him for months in spots that favor her and take down Trump.
Well, presidential races often do tighten. Some think it's because the media want to see a close contest because it's more fun to cover, and they slant coverage to help the underdog make a comeback. But with Trump attacking the media, he's not likely to get more favorable coverage. And if his campaign goes with the let Trump be Trump strategy, his negative and positive ratings won't change enough to close the gap with Clinton. He'd need for her to make some blunders and then pounce on them. And he'd need major bad news to hit the country, bad news that would make voters receptive to him as a so-called strong man. Otherwise, Clinton's lead should hold, even if her momentum slows, and she would win in a landslide.
Dan, you wrote a commentary recently about what could go wrong with Hillary Clinton, how she could still lose this race. What's your biggest worry in that regard as essentially a Clinton Democrat?
Well, the biggest wild card, to my mind, is Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. He's admitted that he leaked emails from the DNC on the first day of the Democratic convention to hurt Clinton. The email showed favoritism toward Clinton and angered Bernie Sanders' followers.
And really shook up the Democratic National Committee.
Absolutely. Now, Assange now claims that he has emails that link Clinton to a French company that might have spent money promoting ISIS.
So you think more is coming from WikiLeaks?
Oh, yeah. That's the real danger lurking over the Clinton campaign.
All right. Let's talk about the presidential debates upcoming. Todd, Clinton has accepted the three that have been suggested. We don't know yet what Donald Trump will do. Do you think he'll want to go one-on-one with Clinton, or will he want third-party candidates mixed in these debates, since he did so well in the primary campaign with a lot of candidates on stage?
Well, if Trump continues to be so far behind in all the swing states, his campaign will need a one-on-one debate with Clinton to change the dynamic of the race. Otherwise, if the Libertarian, Gary Johnson, gets 15% in polls and qualifies for the debates, he'd cut into Trump's time and undermine his message that he's the only candidate who represents change. So while some of Trump's advisors are probably wary of how their candidate will do in debate, they don't have a choice. And if Trump does terribly, they'll say, well, we let Trump be Trump, so it's not our fault.
Very quick question to end this to both of you. Do you think that interest in third parties in this race is going to grow on behalf of voters as we move beyond Labor Day?
I think so, definitely, because there's so much unhappiness with both of the principal candidates in the race.
I agree. If there were a candidate named none of the above, he'd probably be ahead right now.
Todd Domke, thanks very much.
Good to be with you.
Same to you, Dan Payne.
You're welcome, Bob.